to thank everybody for coming to this afternoon's post-council meeting, and extend a thank you to Chief Stratton for this venue. The first item on our agenda is the approval of our June 4th meeting minutes. So you should all have a copy of them. They were placed on the portal for access by Shauna earlier in the month. Motion by Director Cook and by Mr. Austin. Any discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? All right, at this time we're going to go to the quarterly reports and turn the time over to first Lieutenant Acosta and secondly to Lieutenant Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, council members, guests. Just giving you a report of what Post Investigations has received since the last Post Council meeting, which was conducted on in June. We have received 39 complaints have been sent to our office. Of those 39, we have opened up 22 investigations. We have had two administrative hearings. We have had five cases that were closed with no action after reviewing them and investigating them. We have had three voluntary relinquishments. Those three voluntary relinquishments related to these offenses: attempted rape, forcible sexual abuse, excuse me, official misconduct, falsifying government records, and protective violations, reckless endangerment, possession of firearms while intoxicated, and disorderly conduct. We have conducted 341 background investigations. We have currently 57 active investigations that we're looking at, and we have a total of 108 cases that are open. The 57 are actually active. The other ones are in some state of hearing. They're either gone out to, sent to the officers for review and to send back their waivers or request a hearing. Any questions for the investigators?
Okay. Thank you, Lieutenant Acosta.
Thank you very much.
Lieutenant Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The post-council report for the third quarter training bureau. On June 9th, class 308 started with 38 cadets. And August 14th, we graduated 34 law enforcement officers. Class 309 started on July 7th, and in August 11th, they moved on into the law enforcement block of training with 20 cadets up to 30. And so we are scheduled to graduate that class on October 16th. Then on September 2nd, we started class 310 with 18 cadets, and they're scheduled to complete the SFO block on October 7th. And then that class will graduate this December. In the in-service training area, we have held 11 in-service classes, training 235 officers and dispatchers for a total of 228 hours of training. And I'll just read off a couple of the classes that we held. We held one basic dispatch course, one field training officer course, one firearms rifle instructor course, and we did one instructor development, two intoxilizer classes, three radar LIDAR recertifications, one firearms handgun instructor course, and one impact weapons instructor course. So any questions regarding the training report for this quarter? This quarter actually is traditionally a little bit lower in training that we actually offer and that officers sign up, because it ended the fiscal training year at the end of June. So we've now begun the new training year.
Okay, any questions for Lieutenant Brewer? If not, Lieutenant, do you want to just go into the next agenda item?
You bet. Ready for that? There was two audits that were performed this quarter. The first audit was conducted on the Salt Lake Community College, and there are no exceptions to report on that group. They actually do train in the building with us there at Post, and so it's kind of nice to be right there close to them. And if they ever have any questions, that's some of the feedback they have given us. It's easy for them just to walk right upstairs and handle it right then and there, including any type of application questions. They do feel it's good to be so close to us. Any questions regarding the Salt Lake Community College audit before I move on to the next one? Okay, the next audit that was performed this quarter was on the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. They do have a training academy that is still active, and they do have a class in session right now. There are no exceptions to report on that. We have received some feedback from the satellite training group this quarter, and that is they would like us to update we have a video library where we've recorded each class of the academy. And so we're going to work over the next year, because that's a pretty hefty feat to record each class of our new curriculum, to be able to then provide that to the satellite training academy. So when a cadet misses a course, for whatever reason, sometimes they will be sick or have some type of an emergency and miss a day or two of training, we can usually send those training classes home with the cadet, get them caught up with some notes, and then hopefully get them caught up during the training cycle. And so we're going to work closely with our media group and plan that for this next coming training year. So any questions regarding the satellite training audits that we perform, or the two that we perform this quarter? Okay, thank you very much.
You're getting off easy today, Wade.
Yes, sir, thank you.
All right, I'm going to turn the time over now to Director Stevenson, and he'll introduce Sheriff Decker and a URS representative, D. Larson.
Thank you, Chair, Council. We've not had this situation come up since I've been Director of Post. What has happened is Millard County has submitted to URS to determine whether two positions within the correctional facility in Millard County are eligible for the URS retirement, which is Utah Retirement System. Per policy, if there is an appeal, if they do not agree with the URS's ruling on the positions, which in this case the URS ruled that they did not fit the criteria to be eligible for URS retirement, then by statute, the sheriff can make the appeal to the Post Council. And the statute reads, if there's any dispute between the office and a participating employer or employee over any position to be covered, the disputed position shall be submitted to Peace Officer Standards and Training Council. So the format will have the sheriff get up and give his presentation on the two positions, and then the representative from URS will give a rebuttal or provide what they have viewed with their ruling. And then this body will have to vote on whether to accept the proposal to allow them into the retirement system or not. There is an option within the policy where this position or this decision can be sent down to subcommittee for review, formal review, and then later report to the council their findings, and then if this council feels comfortable voting on that recommendation. So with that, I'll turn the time over to Sheriff Decker.
Thank you, Major. My name is Robert Decker. I'm the sheriff of Millard County. I appreciate this chance to talk to Post Council about this. There's two situations to discuss, and I'll just discuss them singularly or individually. To give you a better understanding, I've got first a dispatch supervisor who is corrections certified and attended the academy, I believe, in 2002. At that time, we were encouraged by corrections that anyone who had anything to do with inmates' movement should be a certified corrections officer. And we started with that process, and Deputy Brunson, who were discussing Deputy Shane Brunson, took the Corrections Academy and passed and became a certified corrections officer. His current assignment, he's a dispatch supervisor, but in a small agency, as I think some of you folks can understand, you use your manpower as much as you can in many, many different assignments. So Deputy Brunson, as our dispatch supervisor, monitors activities inside the jail. The dispatch itself was inside of the secure part of our building or inside of the jail. You have to gain access going through locked doors, which one of these dispatchers have to grant you to come in. We've also had him among his other duties, his regular duties as a dispatch supervisor, take out inmates on an inmate work crew assignment. Assigned him on inmate transports, working inside of the kitchen in our culinary with inmates, helping with shakedowns, bookings, those kinds of things. And so that's why I didn't understand why he couldn't be kept as a certified peace officer, certified corrections officer. Those are his assignments. What I did, and I think what caused the confusion, is I didn't rewrite the job description. I just took a job description for a dispatch supervisor and a job description for a corrections officer and just melded the two together. So that, I think, is maybe where some of the confusion came about. In 4914-201, which identifies a position covered under the URS system, placing employees' life or personal safety at risk, certainly any time you're working with inmates, one-on-one or one-on-six when they're out on work crew, can do that. He's completed post-training. Performing duties of actively preventing or detecting crime. He's a corrections officer, so some of that doesn't fit. That consists primarily of providing community protection. Certainly that's what our jails do. And responding to situations of involving threats to public safety. Long story short, I think Deputy Brunson fits those descriptions. And that's why I'm asking you to review that on Deputy Brunson. And that's for our dispatch supervisor currently there. Now, when URS talked to me, they said I wasn't making my job descriptions for the position, I was making it for the individual. And admittedly, in this case and in some other cases in my office, that's what I do. Because once again, we're not loaded with personnel. I don't have somebody to do every function, and so we get by as we can, and this is one way that I do that. Whether he's doing court security or working in the kitchen or his dispatch job, I think in these particular cases he would and should qualify for correction certification. Now, I don't know that any of us have ever done this before, so I'm going to end that. I don't know if I need to present more. If you have questions about him, if that's proper or appropriate, I don't. Chief, if that's.
I think at this time, Sheriff, it'd probably be best to see if there are any questions from the council.
Okay.
And if we need you to provide additional information, we'll come back to you, sir.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Sheriff Edmonds.
Chief.
How long has he served in that capacity as a special
functions officer? Since 2002, I believe, was when he went through the academy.
He hired on
before that, I think in 95 or 6, something like that. But like I say, in 2002, we sent him to the Corrections Academy, and our intention was to send everybody, but then we could see things moving away from that, so we stopped. He was the second of several that we were sending, so. Yes, Sheriff.
Sheriff, are you using it in the jail on an ad hoc basis even today? Is there any chance at all, or are you using him currently in the jail as a corrections officer in addition to his duties in dispatch?
Oh, yes, sir. Yeah. He goes in and helps, like I say, through booking, through shakedowns, through security problems, issues, things like that. We do that.
So he's not exclusively just in dispatch?
No, sir, no.
I think I just want to make a statement, if I could, and we talked about this in the sheriff's meeting just a little while, and this is not for or against the sheriff's proposal. But I think what we need to realize is that there is changes that are going on, and we need to have some flexibility in regards to this particular legislation. For example, for large correctional facilities, you move away from that type of certification for everybody. So in other words, nurses, psychiatrists, doctors, currently at the prison, those folks are required to be correctional officers. Our philosophy is changing, and we're moving in a different direction. In other words, a lot of times the way I explained it, we would, you know, you have an interview process, and you would have three of your best candidates. Number one, we'd skip that person because they didn't want to go to Corrections Academy. Number two, couldn't pass the entry exam to get into Corrections Academy, so we take number three. So I guess all I'm saying is, from the Department of Corrections' point of view, we will also be talking and trying to get legislation that protects the people that are there now, because we have a lot of good people that started off with that mindset. We'll be asking for them to be grandfathered with legislation. So just mostly letting you guys know that's kind of what's going on from our standpoint, since we're bigger. And the sheriff has a smaller organization, but it sounds pretty similar. He's got someone that's just on the opposite side of this that we need to consider. So I just want to throw that out.
Thank Sheriff you. Tracy?
Also, in that same vein, looking at what job responsibilities are, our nurses in the jail, not all of them are corrections or sworn. We do SFO and corrections for some of them based on their duties. They're all nurses, but some of those nurses also are charged with taking individuals and transporting them to the hospital when they're outside the facility based on the need to have law enforcement authority to protect others or to make an arrest if this individual acts up in another crime. So we do some of our nurses in a civilian capacity, and some we do with a law enforcement capacity based on the additional things that they do that require that kind of training and certification because of the exposure that's additional in their job description that isn't in every job description, like the transportation and that.
Colonel Fuhrer.
Yeah. Decker, is this an issue because he was hired on as a dispatcher and he's helping out with corrections rather than being hired on as a correctional officer helping out with dispatch?
That happens quite a bit, and I was going to bring that up. Thank you, Colonel. Yeah, that oftentimes if our dispatch gets busy because we're back in the secure part of the building, our corrections officers step into dispatch and answer phone calls, do the radio, that they know how to do. They're pretty careful about the computer kind of thing. They don't want to page the whole county out, so they're kind of careful with that. But they do, yes. Sheriff.
I also do the same thing in a lot of ways. You know, our functions interact because we are so small. We're a little bit different because we have a secure area for our dispatch. But it is a requirement in my jail for them to give breaks. We task our dispatchers with watching the medical, kitchen, laundry, and they are both certified dispatchers, most of them. There is a division in the way that their pay comes out, in the percentage that's paid into to URS. Do you know how that division has come about with that individual? Whether they pay into the retirement for him as a corrections officer or as a civilian?
They pay into retirement as a public safety retirement, our county, just the same as me or any other deputy.
I think that makes a big deal.
Any other?
Just a question, Sheriff. Do you have a way of, do you have a way, or are you tracking somehow, like with sort of this melded position of like a dispatcher and a corrections officer, are you kind of tracking how much time that person would spend doing correction stuff versus dispatcher supervisor?
If he's out doing corrections type of stuff, generally there's a daily activity report that he would fill out, so that might be in there. But if he's stepping in from a dispatch position to go back in and help in the jail, help in the kitchen, I wouldn't have a way of tracking that. And I'm not going to certify anybody else in dispatch doing that, but because he is, we use him that way. So
what you're saying is it really depends on what's happening, like, at that minute, like at the jail, it's going to determine what he's doing.
Yeah, now, like I say, when he transports or if he takes work crew out, he was trying to qualify as a bailiff, court security, we would have track of that, but not past where he's just stepping out of dispatch and going into, if he was called out of that to go do a transport, I think it would be in there, but I'm not certain of that, counsel.
Sheriff Edmonds?
Well, just a point of clarification, Mr. Bolander. I think it may be somewhat immaterial because if this gentleman is acting as a correctional officer at all, if he is supervising inmates, then he has to be corrections certified. Correct? I want to make sure that everybody on the council understands that. We can't just have a dispatcher who has never been through the correctional block go and supervise inmates. So I think a critical point of distinction there, that if you're going to be supervising inmates, you have to have been through the correctional certification.
Any other questions for Sheriff Decker? Sheriff, anything else you'd like to share with the council?
Chief, what did you say?
Is there any other information you'd like to share with the council, sir?
Not on that subject, not on Deputy Brunson.
Okay, shall we move to your next employee?
We'll move on to...
Let me ask the council, would you rather handle these separately, or is the second situation somewhat similar, Sheriff Decker?
This is a culinary supervisor in the jail, so it's quite different.
Okay. Hey, let's separate them out. So, Sheriff, at this time, I'm going to ask the URS representative to come up.
Thank you.
And then
you
we'll
bet.
Come back to you. Mr. Larson?
My name is D. Larson. I'm the legal counsel for the Utah Retirement Systems, and appreciate this opportunity to come and clarify a few things that are at issue and some things that are not at issue. I want to clarify a couple things. Representing the Utah Retirement Systems, first of all, this isn't an issue about whether a deputy sheriff would be covered by URS or not. All public employees who qualify are covered by URS. The issue is, should a particular position, does it qualify for public safety retirement, or would they be covered under what's commonly called the big system, so the system would cover civilian employees and everything else. So the first question is, should this be public safety retirement or big system retirement? One other thing, this matter is an individual case. So believe it or not, you're not actually, according to the statute, making a resolution on a particular individual. But the role of the post council, the role of Utah Retirement Systems, the role of employers is to look at positions, not individuals, in which positions qualify under the statutes for public safety retirement. As you know, some of the differences, the public safety retirement is the 20-year retirement versus the 30-year in the big system. It has a much higher contribution rate. We're talking about, it depends on the employers, in the 40% versus 20%. And from the beginning of the creation of that system, it was intended to be a limited system, and so there's narrow qualification standards that have to be looked at. So let's, with a little bit of that, and one of the other things that's not at stake is post-certification. So this doesn't jeopardize anybody's post-certification as a correction officer, the need to have that or not. That's just one element that's looked at in a number of things with whether there's public safety retirement qualification or not. So what you ultimately have to decide is which type of positions qualify, and when you determine those positions, and this is something the Post Council, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't probably decided in nearly 20 years. In the 1980s, there were a lot of these kinds of actions, and things have pretty well settled down, and there's good understanding. And part of what becomes critical is the job descriptions of the individuals, as well as a look at the job duties. That sometimes the way the employer can classify somebody as being involved in dispatch versus a correctional officer position is tantamount. And so sometimes when these issues come up, the proper job classification can actually take care of that. Our job at URS is not to micromanage employers and get into all of that, but look at it systemically, because this has ramifications and consequences, and I don't view this as an adversarial action. We want to make sure that the right things are done for the public safety system. And so with that, if you make an election to take a dispatch supervisor kind of position, qualified now for public safety retirement, that applies across the system to all employers. So we're not, it's not the case of one individual. And in fact, under the statutes, similarly situated people could go and apply for retro benefits. So they could say, I have these years of service, and the employer would then be, employers of similarly situated people would be required to make up the difference in those contributions, so 20% of salary, just offhand figure, plus compounded interest over the period of that time, to then award them public safety service as well. So there's a lot at stake, and so that's why I'm glad you're carefully considering these things. So let me just go into section Utah Code section 49.15.201. I'm using this one. This is the non-contributory system, chapter 14.201. Similar thing for the contributory, but most of your employers, your agencies are in the non-contributory system. There's a couple of things that go on. I'm going to jump down. I'll start out in section one. So the first thing, this gets into definitions. The defined term is a public safety service employee. And so we jump back. Section 49.15.102 defines this term of public safety service, which means being a law enforcement officer, correctional officer, or special function officer, as those terms are defined in the Public Safety Code, Title 53. And then public safety service requires in the course of employment the employee's life or personal safety is also at risk. So it requires the certification and this risk factor there. And it requires full-time service. There's not both full-time or part-time eligibility in the public safety retirement systems, unlike there may be in the big system. So that's the first thing. Then jumping down into some things, there's a process that is helpful, and most employers are following this, and this helps to eliminate whatever confusion might be there. This is down into subsection 5. This says, each participating employer, so in this case this is the law enforcement agency, shall annually submit to the office a schedule indicating the positions to be covered under the system. So which positions are going to be public safety? And unfortunately, we're now facing some confusion that happened back in 2002. In the Utah Retirement System files, there are communications between the Millard County Sheriff's Office and URS about the dispatch supervisor position, and notes made that position, dispatch positions, don't qualify under the public safety retirement system, that there would need to be some reclassifications and so forth. Not a lot was done. Then part of the case, this case is being brought as a result of an employer audit from the last period. In the last few years, there have been greater efforts to do audits and reconciliations of these reports versus the contributions being made. And so as a URS employer audit was conducted, this report showing the covered the positions that should be submitted annually did not include the dispatch supervisor position, but looking at the records of contributions showing that. And so it was in 2003, kind of coming in the back door, the contributions were made to bring somebody on, and despite the earlier discussion that dispatch positions with those kind of job classifications typically wouldn't qualify. And these are the standards that I'll get to next of that. So if the position was properly classified, I think that would have raised or been properly reported on an annual basis. That would have helped resolve this issue earlier, but nevertheless, we face that now. So these are the issues if there's a dispute. So the Utah Retirement Systems has a committee that went through, looks principally at those the job title, looking at the job descriptions, getting information from the employer, had a committee and looked at this. And the dispatch position, like I said, has a 20-year history. There was in about 1994, 1995, a couple of sessions in there. There were actually bills to allow dispatchers into public safety retirement, and legislative decision was made not to do that. So if somebody has shared positions, and I know a lot of you have that, the job classifications can be much, so it's a correctional officer who does things. And these are the statutes that come into play. I'm going to jump down to 10. To determine that a position is covered, and these are the standards that we used, the office, so this is the Utah Retirement Systems Office, And if a coverage dispute arises, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Council, so we're in here together now, shall find that the position requires the employee to place the employer's life or personal safety at risk. They have to complete the training, and then they shall consider where the position requires the employee, and these are the key words, perform duties that consist primarily of actively preventing or detective enforcing criminal statutes, performing duties that consist primarily of providing. So that the primacy of the position, if it's classified as a dispatch supervisor who assists with corrections versus a correctional officer who goes, that this is determinative, and our committee, based upon that, unanimously voted not to cover this position. So it wasn't a question about an individual, but system-wide dispatchers wouldn't be covered. So I think those are the key points that I wanted to bring up. I'm happy to answer any of the questions that you might have. Yes?
The definition of primary, is that based off a percentage?
It's not a defined term in the catch. So I would use the common definition. So a preponderance, that it's the principal or chief duty.
About the same question. I mean, it's we have to make those decisions all the time on where we're going to place our employees, just like the sheriff has said. Mm-hmm. In a small agency, you can't afford to hire a person for every position. You have to kind of diversify with your employees. So what you're telling us is what we need to do is take the highest qualified person, and where this individual is certified, he went through the certification, he has completed everything that brings him into that realm of a certified individual. He's being paid by the county into the URS system for that purpose. Even though he has a title, is he getting harmed by that title, or is he getting harmed by his training?
I don't think the training, I would set that aside. The issue is the title, and then looking at the function is what's primary. So recognizing these kinds of things, if I'm an employer, one of the processes we have in place is if there's ever a position that's in question, we have staff, I have our director of records management, some others, field these questions to say, I've got this kind of position. And you can get them pre-cleared and pre-reviewed, and then if they're submitted on the annual report, that goes up. So it's kind of a lowest common denominator kind of thing, that if you want somebody covered by public safety retirement, make sure that classification, the duties as described, their principal duties, and including the life at risk and these other factors that are here in the statute, make it a correctional officer position, make sure that it meets a law enforcement officer, one of those elements, so it's clearly covered by the public safety system. There may be a variety of duties, but if that becomes the primary duty in the job description, so forth, it meets the public safety standards, and then we don't have issues with these statutes. This isn't something that we as administrators of the retirement system have a lot of discretion. They're pretty clear standards that we have to evaluate. Our professional staff evaluated them. That's why they made the determination. This is a person based upon that title and description right now that should be covered under the big system, not the public safety system. Like I say, if we were to change that and say now dispatch supervisors, it has consequences beyond one individual.
I still have a follow-up. Yes, if I would. You mentioned that it would be a harm to the county if this all went through to bring that level of contribution back up to somebody, to all these that might apply afterwards. This individual, to my knowledge, sounds like he's been paid, the county has been paying in. If he is not being able to be under the peace officer's qualifications, it looks like to me then that will have to come back from URS to come back to the county because they've already paid for this individual.
Yeah, and I'm not prepared to address that individual case. We can look at remedies there, but clearly if job classifications are changed and so forth moving forward, I think things can be dealt with.
Question, you said in 2003 they first recognized this, is that correct?
For in 2002, we have some notes of discussions with the employer saying that dispatcher positions are not eligible for public safety retirement. And so in 2003, the contributions for membership in that got paid, and it's a more recent audit. But it wasn't reported on that list, too, so there's a little bit of discrepancy in it. So that was found. That's what brought this case forward and raised this issue.
The rate that they were accepting at the higher public
safety? Yes, they were paying the higher public safety rate, so they were paying that higher contribution. And what I'm saying from this isn't a position that was on the list submitted. It isn't a position that should have been eligible under those statutes. So the person was paid, so it's not an issue about the contribution to the money. But it's really about these positions, and should dispatch supervisors be eligible under the statutes for public safety retirement rather than retirement in the big system?
So, Mr. Larson, could, especially with our smaller agencies where many employees perform various tasks, and the hiring freezes that a lot of these employers have been faced on, forcing employees to work various functions, could something like this be resolved by developing different job function or job descriptions? So you could have a dispatch supervisor job description. That employee under the current rules would be in the big system and would be compensated whatever the county feels fair. But in the case, something similar to what Sheriff Decker has, where that employee is transporting prisoners, taking them out on work details, which in my mind qualifies because we had a correctional officer murdered at the U Medical Center doing just that. So if the counties or the employers were to come up with a secondary job description that said not only are you a correctional officer and have to have the prerequisite certifications, but you're also going to be a dispatch supervisor, and that position may be paid differently than just a general dispatch supervisor, would that resolve these issues?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That was alluded to with corrections. I've had some discussions with state corrections. They have been doing a bunch of, well, I'll call them for simplified, combo positions. So that would be qualified as public safety and have normal civilian kinds of capacities as well. But it's one of the things is carefully writing these job descriptions to make sure the primary functions are those that qualify for coverage under the system. And so in their discussions there, it's a little bit of the opposite, trying to take some of the positions back to civilian only. And you do that by carefully crafting your job descriptions. So you clarify, these are civilian positions, this is one that requires the post certification, which is one element, but in addition, you know, it has enforcement duties, these are the primary duties, it involves risk and so forth. Then I think there's not that problem, because one of the things we don't want is additional confusion. You start approving a dispatch title position, I think you're going to get a run of other people saying, hey, I'm a dispatcher, I learned dispatchers are now covered. We're going to get a run on those kinds of things. So I think we need to be careful to have the clear job descriptions that you've referred to.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Larson?
I just have a real quick question. So what requirement in Section 201.10b did the URS committee decide that this particular position did not meet?
There
weren't any issues with the first two requirements in 10a. It sounds like it's more like an issue with what's in 10b. I'm just curious what
I think. I think there are findings on 10a, Romanet I, about placing the employer's life or personal safety at risk. You know, you can occasionally have that, but is that a routine part of the job? So I wasn't in that meeting, but it's my understanding that's part of it. And then this the primacy of the job functions. So in those combinations, and they had multiple discussions in light of the audit and other things going back to there. So it's that is the area of concern.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Larson. We'll invite you back up in a minute. All right, we have the issue before the council. Any discussion? Chief Carpenter?
I guess I'm confused why it took 11 years to figure this out if they were receiving the rate at the higher public safety rate, why they're just dealing with it now.
Mr. Larson, do you want to address that question? Because I certainly can't.
No, there's an increased audit function in the last several years. The audit staff has come up, which I know all of your employment agencies love, but it's making that back. There's always been this statutory requirement as an employer each year to list all of the positions, not necessarily the names, but those positions that qualify under public safety. It wasn't on that list to kind of, I think that having a dispatch position on that list would have jumped it out. I mean, we deal with 165,000 active participants, and so there's a lot of different things. That's no excuse, but it is an audit that was reconciling the report of the positions versus the contributions and found an extra person on the system that wasn't qualified. So, as I say, it's just in the last few years, if you hear more complaints about looking at records, we really are trying to find these things early on. We do not want any more than anybody else for these things to go on, because that creates a few more issues as we look at individual remedies to deal with. But that's the best of my understanding.
Mr. Crowley?
What I'm seeing is you've got a corrections officer supervising civilian staff. I don't know about other agencies, but we have corrections officers supervising civilian staff at our office all the time. And that's what I think he's getting. It sounds like it's tied up on the word dispatcher. This guy's doing transporting work crews out. I mean, we stop checking work crews all the time, tell UHP if they see them out, stop missing, for the first simple fact that six inmates and one corrections officer, I think that qualifies as it. So. That's what I'm hearing from both sides is you got a corrections officer certified in 2002, takes inmates out, does transports, work crews, booking, all the stuff, but he supervises dispatch. I mean, unless I'm confused.
I understand where URS is coming from. We have 100 dispatchers, and if a dispatcher's supervisor is classified in the 54% category rather than the 38, that's caused huge ramifications for budgets. And if a dispatch supervisor is given that qualification to be in the public safety retirement, then every single 100 dispatchers would fall in that line publicly as well. What I'm wondering is, can we say that it was a mistake the way that he was titled and retroactively change his title back from when he was hired rather than dispatch supervisor to correctional officer so that we're dealing with the one individual rather than the whole system, or is that not possible? How do you
correct
officer?
We'll kind of tie into the
Mr. Larson, would you respond to that question before we take another
shot? I don't disagree with the general principle, but it's a little bit bigger than a job title because I've just pulled out the job description. I don't want to spend all the time reading it, but it talks about the general purpose and functions, has long descriptions of all of the duties involved in supervising communications and all the dispatch functions, and then just says, where is this? Performs duties as needed to transport and acts as bailiff and things as it has this as needed. And so this is, goes to that primary function. It's not just a title, but looking at the primary function involved in there. So I think that can be resolved, nevertheless, but it's not as simple as just changing the title, but I think it's this job description. If that matches with what's really happening, I don't see a problem with that. And that may be, and over the time from when there was the initial contributions being paid, you know, this job may have evolved as a lot do. And so I think this is where human resources functions become important to make sure those stay current so that the titles, the job descriptions accurately describe what's happening. And if there's factually, that is the primary duties and those things, then it can meet the statutory standards. We're just saying, based upon what's been submitted to us, we didn't find that it met that at this time.
Right. Director Cook?
I was just going to add, I've only been in law enforcement corrections 25 years, and we have had sworn members supervising civilians forever. And it just sounds to me like it's just been mislabeled. And I know you don't want to hear that, but we all do it. We have sworn members that act as supervisors over different areas, and because of the size of the county, you're using that person to supervise the dispatch, but you're also having them do transport and stuff. And that's been going on for a long time. I don't see it as a new issue. Even if the auditor came in and said, this is what's happened, it just common sense is that person's a correctional officer, they're doing those duties, and they're also supervising the dispatch. And I just mislabeled.
Bailey?
The 11-year mark, I also wonder if maybe URS was giving the sheriff the impression, since he was paying at the higher rate, that they were acknowledging him as a public safety, since you were paying the higher rate for 11 years, correct?
We were paying the peace officer public safety retirement rate. He has always been paid the dispatch supervisor rate, not a corrections officer rate.
But what he's paying in the URS.
But in the URS, that rate has been paid at a public safety rate.
So could they have been giving you the impression that they were okay with him being public safety because you were paying the higher rate and they didn't say anything to you for 11 years?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of the problem until they did their. I think we wrote a letter a time or two, where it went, but stating what our function was over the years. I don't think I've wrote one. I've been the sheriff since 2006, and I don't think I've written a letter. But I know they've questioned a couple of times that incident or that qualification or that description. And I tried to, as he said, in May of this year, I tried to adjust that. Now, his duties are communication supervisor. But we also send him out on a transport or on a work crew or something like that. So. That's where we've come into that, and paid the public safety rate. But we've looked at that individually, and not as a group. He's talking about a group, and my employees, each one is important. So I've adjusted, and they told me when they came down that I was wrong in worrying about individuals. I just should worry about an assignment, and that's all. I disagree with that, so.
Any other questions or comments? I see the dilemma both ways. I have my own communication center. I have a communications manager. They're on the big system. They have no other duties outside of running my communication center. So that's clear. But when you have somebody that's performing law enforcement duties as a correctional officer in addition to that, that muddies the water, hence we're here today, but I definitely see perhaps a need to better clarify a job description for when you have a dual purpose employee filling that position as Sheriff Decker does versus a single employee or single purpose employee such as my communications manager. All right. Seeing no other questions or comments, I'll bring it back to the council for a motion. I would like to remind the council that no motion is a no vote. If I'm correct, is that correct, Director Stevenson? Or I can't force a vote.
Remind the council of the option of subcommittee.
That's right. We do have an option that Director Stevenson pointed out. We could remand this to a committee to further study this and then hear their recommendation for a resolution at a future post-council meeting. During that time, perhaps a more specific job description could be developed. And I think Mr. Bolander wants to jump in on this one.
Go ahead. So, sorry, I was just trying to get a grasp of what direction you're going. So it sounds like the council members need more time to think about this before we deliberate,
Well, basically, if the council wants to have a subcommittee look into it, get more information from Mr. Larson, more information from Sheriff Decker, formulate a recommendation to the council, then they can bring it back. We hear their recommendation. We've already heard the testimony from Mr. Larson and from Sheriff Decker, and then we would consider.
Yeah, so they just
have
the recommendation and the council votes on that.
Correct.
So,
Sheriff Tracy.
My question would be, during the time of this study, would URS just hold stationary on its position? Would there be a change or a movement to reduce this individual off of public safety unless there was a favorable recommendation if we sent this to a subcommittee?
We've had the opportunity, we could have, with our determination, move the person to the system, but we agreed to keep the status quo pending this appeal to post. as long as this does, I know you don't meet quite as often as some groups, but if you will keep working on this, we can maintain the status quo for a little while to let that be resolved. I think that would be acceptable.
Well, the next post-council meeting would be in 3 months in December. And I would assume that we'd have a recommendation back from the committee by then.
Well, keep in mind by statute, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it does read the council's decision can only be applied prospectively unless, you know, there's two exceptions. I don't know if they apply here or not. I mean, it's in section 201.4c3. But that is my understanding, is the council's decision can only be applied prospectively as far as whether that position is going to be eligible for the public safety reclassification system.
Correct.
But there is some retroactive into similarly situated people we can get into. But as I say, this issue for you really is the high-level one about the position and whether it meets those qualifications to be included in public safety. You know, the individual issues with our members, and although I made it clear, this is not a case about an individual. I recognize this impacts a couple of individuals highly, and we work with them on an individual basis to resolve those remedies. That isn't something that you as the council have to take up. You're looking at the broader view of position qualification.
Yes, Chair Tracy.
Based on the statement by URS that this could have ramifications across the state, I think it's a complicated issue that could have significant impact monetarily and both in people's lives. I would suggest that we do, or I would even make a motion that we put together a subcommittee to study this, to look at what solutions can be found for more than just one job description, but this problematic existence of this entire class of people that does exist in many of these agencies across the state.
So we have a motion and a second to form a committee and have the committee report back. Would you want to give a timeline on reporting back, Sheriff?
That we should be able to prepare something by the next post-council meeting.
All right. Is that agreeable, Mr. Cook? All right. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion or questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, both parties will receive a written determination after our December meeting of the decision of the post-council. Sheriff Decker, do you want to bring your second matter before the council now?
Yes, thank you. Won't matter a whit to you, but I think your decision on the last one is great. If we can resolve it in that matter, that'd be great. Talking to you now about Penny Prowse. She's a deputy sheriff, certified corrections officer, and she's assigned to our kitchen. She's a kitchen supervisor. And she's the only staff member inside of the kitchen. There are four to five inmates inside of the kitchen to prepare the meals, to wash the dishes, to take care of those kinds of things. But she's inside the kitchen. She wears a uniform. She has worked out in the jail previously but applied for this job, so she is being paid as a culinary supervisor. She does have a correction certificate, and I couldn't tell you the date, but it's been several years. And so she's back in with the inmates, alone inside with the inmates. She's monitored by some cameras, and as deputies, as they do their walkabouts or checks throughout the building. She also assists, because she's a female. I don't have a bunch of female deputies down there to help me, so, man, we pick female help up all over the place down there just because we have to. We've trained our secretary staff, some of our female dispatchers, just to help us on searches and things like that, which is, as you know, a legal thing to do. That's all they do is assist and that kind of thing. But she goes in and she'll help on bookings, she'll help on releases, she'll help on shakedowns, searches in the cells, those kinds of things. So she's involved daily with the inmates. She'll take the inmates back to their block, pick them up if they need to be picked up to come back into the jail. She's handling inmates daily. So I'm not sure, and maybe it's a description, again, that I've messed up on. I think we've combined the two. The position prior to hers was not certified. The fellow that occupied that position before was not a certified corrections officer. As this position came open, Penny had been working in the jail, in the kitchen. She would just simply promote it, and it's a good fit because she is corrections certified, and that's something that we'd like to try and continue, should budgets allow. But that's my spiel to you today is I don't know what else she could do. She's doing the same thing that the corrections officers inside the jail are doing. Handling of inmates, one-on-one, searches, bookings, releases. Most recently, a couple of weeks ago, she helped us handle a mental subject right inside the holding cells and does a good job. That's what she does. That's how she does it, and I'd be open for any questions on her.
Okay, thank you, Sheriff. Questions for Sheriff Decker? Sheriff Tracy, you look like you're formulating one.
Not a question. I'll make a statement in a minute, though.
I think it would be so.
Okay. This situation exactly is something that we duplicate. We have two kitchen directors or managers who are sworn. Their primary purpose is to conduct kitchen activities with 20 inmates. I don't see any difference between that and an individual who takes 20 inmates out and cleans the side of the road to produce a clean road. The product is food in this instance in our kitchen, but those certified two out of the seven cooks that we have and the 20 inmates, those two are tasked with kitchen security at all times with inmates who have at their disposal large knives to cut food with. And this is a direct thing that impacts us, and I don't see how we can provide that security and require that individual to maintain security without law enforcement authority at their disposal, meaning they need to be corrections certified, and we do SFO on top of that. But this is directly a thing. They are managing inmates daily through the entire work period who are producing a product that is true. And these individuals have kitchen skills and manager skills in culinary arts, but they are directly inmate attached to those workers at all times. So I see that as a security issue that has kitchen ramifications, but I don't know how you get around that without having a sworn individual in that position.
Sheriff Smith?
It's the same comment. I still think that if the sheriff has gone through the process with HR to pay get him to pay the fee in as a correctional officer to URS, certify him, they meet the criteria. I know job description is very important, but as some of the times as sheriffs and chiefs, we move people where they can best be utilized. And in a security facility like most sheriffs have, we try to do with the best person we have. And sometimes we don't get to the job description till the very last. And so I still think it goes back to, are they certified? Have they gone through the training? Are they, is the money being paid by the county into URS for that position? I think that's very important, and I hope that's what this committee looks at.
Director Cook?
I guess I just want to continue to make the point that I think the demographics of Utah are really showing here. We've seen that in the Prison Relocation Commission as things have come up. We basically have one metro area and then we have a lot of rural area. And we have different needs that are in there. And that's why I continue to say I think we need the flexibility to allow the sheriffs to do this. But there's other operational philosophies in large prisons that go away from that type of supervision. It's just different. It's different in size and so on. So, again, I know we've got to have rules and laws and all these kind of things, but I think we need to be flexible enough to be able to get the right people into the right jobs. And everything that you're saying that person's doing reminds me of when I was in Salt Lake County. That's what we did. Sheriff Tracy's model is the same. In fact, I think we have your culinary guy. But I want people to understand, from the big point of view, we're moving away from that in the new technology facilities and stuff like that. But we've got to take care of the sheriffs as well. So there's got to be some flexibility somewhere. Probably too wishy-washy.
Well, I see the flexibility coming up in the dual job descriptions. One is you're a correctional officer and your assignment is culinary arts, but you're still expected to do that law enforcement functions. The other, you're a culinary arts director, and you have no law enforcement expectation. You never pull them out to transport a prisoner. They don't go on the cell block. They don't do shakedowns. Different animal. And I think that you're absolutely right, Mr. Cook, on that flexibility.
Yep, Dr. Budd. My sense is we tend to agree around this table as to what ought to be done. It's just not possible to do it the way it's currently structured. I don't think it necessarily needs to be a motion, but I think this committee that's studying this issue can come back, it perhaps should come back with a recommendation as to a job description that would properly include these kinds of duties. It's clear what's happening. It's clear these individuals are performing, at least in part, as correctional officers, peace officers, and we should have a job description that meets that. I would think that subcommittee that's going to be formed or will be formed could come back with that recommendation.
I agree. Sure, Tracy.
One last comment. I see this one different than the dispatch. I mean, because we don't hire inmate dispatchers, and I doubt that Sheriff Decker does either, but this individual that's in the kitchen and that supervises inmates that goes out and cleans the road, you know, the day that he goes out and cleans the road, we don't make him a sanitation engineer. He's still a deputy. He's in control and direct control of inmates and for providing for their safety and the community's safety while he is interacting with them. So I would see this one a little different than the first one in that regard, where you've got somebody who's constantly all day long working with inmates based on their location within the correction system and their job.
All right. Any other comments, discussion? Thank you, Sheriff Decker.
Thank you.
Okay, we're Mr. Larson.
Based upon the presentation and your comments, you understand the issue. It's similar, different position, but it really does come down to the facts and circumstances related to that position. It's not really tied to just as an employer making those contributions, then determining eligibility, but there are these statutory standards, and there is a lot of flexibility built in. As we say, if people have new kinds of positions and things, they're able to talk to our records division and get those things worked out. I would ask that you'd treat this with the same subcommittee so we can look at these issues and come back, have things resolved, hopefully. Thank you for your time and consideration, because these are important issues that we really value. The public safety retirement system, it needs to be handled correctly so that costs, eligibility, everything else are contained, and we'll be happy to work with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Larson. Yes, John.
So, rewrite the job description.
There's a lot of departments that have dual position that have passed audit kind of scrutiny. A couple of things. That's one element.
If you rewrote the job descriptions to match exactly what they do, that would make this a better place.
The title becomes important, and that's part of the job description. But then when it if that's what does match the facts, because there is the statutory standard of primary duties, and so if it says these duties are primary, I mean, we're not going to get into that a great level. We work with the employers on that, but we just, you know, where there's been an issue, we just say, so it's not just a paper description. But if that's realistically what's done, and that we're not out holding up some kind of ruler to measure that, but if it really is primarily consisting of those kind of correctional duties, there wouldn't be a problem there and things could be resolved.
Well, I think it's very important that we address this properly so we don't open Pandora's box of, in the case of the correction or the culinary arts director who has law enforcement responsibilities, the next one in doesn't, but says my predecessor was, and if there's a riot in the jail and I help the deputies, I'm now performing a law enforcement function, so I should be on public safety retirement. I think we need to really manage that. I think that's what Mr. Larson may be referring to, because it's going to affect everybody, just not Millard County. So. All right. Well, I think the suggestion to have the subcommittee look at this case as well as the first case is a good idea. So that being said, is there any other comments or discussion on the matter? And we'll bring it up for a motion.
Motion to set it to the subcommittee with the first group.
All right. Second. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
We will ask for volunteers for the subcommittee at the conclusion of the meeting. All right. Thank you, Sheriff Decker. Thank you, Mr. Larson. As with the first matter, you will receive written notification of the council's decision after the December meeting. Director Stevenson, you're next. Update on in-service training hours.
Thank you, Chair. Just for edification for the audience, I know the council is well aware of the statutory mandate under 536202-4A and B that requires peace officers to obtain 40 hours of continuing education annually. Those are to be reported to post by the departments, and we've completed our audit. In fact, we have completed our audit, and we've identified some individuals that have fallen short of reaching that number. The policy is that by July 1, that's when departments have to report to post whether their officers are within statutory requirement, therefore still eligible to be a police officer. If we have not received that 40-hour mark, as of August 1, those officers are ruled deficient, and a suspension letter is sent out suspending their authority to exercise peace officer duties. As of August 1, we had 224 officers that were suspended due to deficiency hours, and to date we have 48 that are still on the deficient list. When we come up to October 1, this number will be reported to URS, and URS will decide what to go from there as far as their eligibility to remain in the retirement system, public safety retirement system. But I anticipate that number dropping considerably from today until October 1. So, Sheriff.
Do you send that to the agency and those individuals?
Yes, we do. Yes.
Any other questions? It's good not to be on that list.
Sure.
Have they been non-responsive, the agency heads, so far?
No, we've received considerable response, 224 down to 48. So that, you know, I've had some personal calls from administrators asking about that. Yeah, they're not happy.
Any other questions for Director Stevenson on this issue? All right. Director, you want to go to legislative items?
Please. We've been working with Department of Corrections, Director Cook, as it pertains to basic corrections training, special functions training. In practice, they've been sending people through the SFO block in their own in-house academy. As a foundation to move on to the basic corrections certification. We like that idea, and I would like to make that kind of a foundational certification as it is for law enforcement certification. So that would make it a requirement for basic correctional officers to obtain SFO, even though that's been practice, but to put a little more teeth to that, to enforce that, I would like to put that in our administrative rule. I think I've looked at the statute, and I'm going to get with Kevin Bolander and Marcus Yockey to make that determination, but I think we can handle it under administrative rule. But I wanted to take this to the Sheriff's Association before we move forward and have a proposed curriculum by the December council meeting, because I know this has some impact on the counties as well. So I'm just asking for a vote in concept, and then I'll report back to the council in December, working with corrections very closely and the sheriffs.
Okay. Sheriff?
I'll make the motion that we support in concept.
Okay. We have a second by Sheriff Smith. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay, moving on. Under other legislative items. Last session, I brought a bill to Representative Greenwood to add a sanction to not reporting to peace officer standards and training any officer misconduct. From time to time, whatever the case may be, we don't get the cases in a timely manner. Administrators are busy, but I've talked to quite a few administrators that have expressed some support in adding a sanction to that. Currently is just in statute, and there is no sanction to non-reporting. So the time frame is not established, so theoretically they're not in violation by reporting it to us a week or a month or 6 months later. So I drafted a bill and had some concerns brought to my attention, but what I am seeking is just a vote of support in concept. I will send out language to the council for support, input, whatever the case may be, to get a good bill ready for the next session. If you're not in support of it in concept, I would like to know and give me some options so that we ensure that the statute is being applied fairly across the state and not just from one or two jurisdictions.
Any questions for Director Stevenson? One thing I think is important that, and you may be doing this, Director, is we've in the last few years had quite a few new chiefs come into state from out of state that may not be totally familiar with the Post Reporting Council, and every 4 years we have new sheriffs come through that also may not be aware of it. So I think if we implement mandatory reporting, which we have with a sanction, that some type of mechanism be brought up to where as new chiefs are appointed or new sheriffs are appointed, that the requirement for them is made clear, especially for out-of-state candidates that come in. A lot of, as you're aware, a lot of states, Post does not function in the capacity that we're functioning here.
Correct.
Today. So it's a foreign concept to some of our new agency administrators. So,
and I presented to the Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association as well. That could be part of annual training or whatever level of training you see fit. I will do what the council requests.
Anybody have any input for the director on this topic?
Just a comment. I think that's very very good to take to the chiefs and the sheriffs. I think there's going to be some concerns on the guidelines. What should be, what shouldn't be, what they'd be happy to do. I know we've had these comments before.
There may be a consequence that I don't anticipate or can't anticipate because I'm not in that world. But yeah, I anticipate a lot of feedback and involvement with this one.
And I think this is an important issue because I'm aware of incidents throughout the state that should have been reported to Post and for whatever reason have not been. And under current law, there's an agency that can come up with any number of reasons why that hasn't happened. And I think that the potential for harm that we as administrators is that or face is that employee might leave employment and apply elsewhere. And the matter is never addressed, and then we're hiring somebody else's problem. Because an agreement is made by the currently employing agency that we won't say anything if you resign and leave. And when you do a background check, they don't say anything. So some people go ahead and hire people that we probably should not have functioning in those positions. So I think it's
and Chair, if I could just mention to the council, one of the sticking points of the proposed legislation last year was when should it be reported, and whether it was the accusation coming forward should be forwarded to post or mentioned to post and then leave it up to post to follow up to retrieve that information, or when the department has decided that there is in fact a violation in the statute, then it should be reported. So there's a good and bad with either approach. But I think it'd be a good direction to head if we put a sanction to it and some teeth to this statute.
Right. I agree. Okay, any other comments? No? All right. Thank you, Director Stevens.
I have one more. I just love this attention.
It's going to be a busy legislative session.
Met with Representative Lee and Representative Oda over some ideas that they've had about private investigators and constables. They are putting together some language to address what a private investigator can and cannot do, and also looking at constables and the type of training that they receive and whether it supports the actual duties they perform out in the field. I've mentioned and kind of brainstormed a little bit with the staff as a possibility to propose to the representatives a constable certification instead of just the special functions. Special functions, as you're well aware, does not address firearms issues and various levels of force when it involves weapons and verbal conflict. And so by putting together a constable certification, it would be designed for constables and the duties that they face in the field. Instead of them just getting kind of the basic SFO and then going out to their individual constables to receive training in firearms, we can be assured that they are receiving the same objectives across the state and creates uniformity overseen by this body. That's just some of the ideas that have been floating around. I'm not asking for a vote in concept, but please be aware that that bill is most likely going to come forward in the upcoming legislative session.
Director, how would expanding that affect your budget?
I proposed that we would not train them. It would be through the satellite academies. So the applicant would be responsible for encumbering the cost related to training. We would just be responsible for designing the curriculum, for its content, and then this body would approve it, and these satellites would deliver the product.
All right, thank you. Sheriff Tracy?
That component would include a firearms portion of qualification,
yes, I would expect so.
If the statement is true that you're looking for consistency across the state with that, why then do we not have firearms in the SFO?
That's a good question.
What?
Well, most SFOs are either correctional officers or constables. Your departments, I gotta walk around with this carefully. I'm not saying that these organizations are not professional, but sheriffs, departments, and DOC, we know the training that you provide your employees. I will leave it at that.
Thank you, Director Stevenson. We'll move on to the next agenda item. Mr. Yaki, if you'd like to bring us through our disciplinary cases.
Good
First, the first matter before the post council is a certification of Richard Todd Bills. He is a former officer with the Box Elder County Sheriff's Office. Sustained allegations are assault, domestic violence, and domestic violence in the presence of a child, which falls under Category C of the post-disciplinary guidelines. Post-recommended discipline is 3.5 years, and this is based on the amount of the offenses and the nature of the offenses. A summary of the facts are as follows. On June 26, 2013, Richard Todd Bills and his wife got in an argument at their residence. During the altercation, Bills pushed his wife, hit her in the face with an open hand, pulled her by her hair, and laid on top of her until she could not breathe. Bill's wife's 10-year-old daughter was in the home at the time of the incident and heard the altercation. Bills and his wife were investigated by local police, and domestic violence charges were filed on both individuals. Bills later pled guilty to an amended charge of disorderly conduct. On September 15, 2014, Richard Todd Bills waived his right to a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in a notice of agency action.
Thank you. Is Mr. Bills or a representative here that would like to address the council? Sir, please step out to the podium and state your name, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Richard Todd Bills. First of all, I'd like to thank you guys for your time and for the opportunity to be able to address the council. I'd like to recognize the Box Elder County Sheriff's Office representatives that are here to support me. Sheriff Yates wasn't able to make it. He's tending to his wife, and Chief Deputy is actually picking up his extra duties. My road into law enforcement started years ago, and before I got into law enforcement, you know, I had what I needed. I had a good job. I was an electrician, made over $20 an hour. And then in the wake of 9/11, the company I worked for directly serviced the airports, and a year later I found my number come up, and I was laid off, and I had the opportunity to reinvent myself and actually go after something that I wanted to do. I started the academy, and about halfway through the academy I got a call back from my employer. And so I went back to Jetway while I finished up the academy. 6 months after the academy, I got an offer to work for Box Elder County. I went from over $20 an hour to $13.47. So it was a huge hit, but it didn't matter because that's what I wanted to do. I've lived my life making good decisions, good choices, and it shows in where I've actually managed to go. But in this incident, I screwed up. I found myself in a violent situation, and taking the outside stimulus and trying to respond to that and control a situation that was spiraling rapidly out of control. Next thing I know, I was sucked deeper into it than what I realized. And I made choices that I can't say I'm proud of. But they weren't choices. They weren't malicious choices. They weren't out of malice. They weren't premeditated choices. They weren't made for personal gain. It was the inability for me to take everything that was happening and being able to process and actually make sound judgment call at that time. And like I said, This isn't common for me. I had a full career with Box Elder County, and I was known for making solid, sound judgments. But in the blink of an eye, one situation spiraled so far out of control, I couldn't control it. I think my biggest regret was I should have asked for help. I should have recognized the fact that I couldn't control the situation. As much as I wanted to control it, as much as I wanted to regain the order, I couldn't do it. And I should have recognized that, and I should have called for help, and I should have gotten assistance there. And I've had over a year to think about the whys and beat myself up about why I didn't. And I honestly can't say exactly why. I don't know if it was embarrassment, having to have somebody else come in and help me. I can't say, you know, whether I was worried about getting my wife in trouble, whether I was worried about just bringing all those outside forces into my home. So the best I can come up with is I didn't call for help because I was scared. And in the first time in my life, I allowed that fear to overcome me, and I didn't call for help. And I wouldn't have a problem if somebody stood here and called me a coward, because I've been scared before. But I can't say that I've been scared and just not reacted. I've been scared and still managed to make good choices and follow through and keep my head on. I'm looking at a recommendation for 3.5 years, and I don't know that I necessarily agree to that. You guys have the facts in front of you, but this was a single, isolated episode in my life, a life of good choices, sound decisions, and solid judgments. I understand consequences, though, and I understand ownership of having to own your actions and accept your consequences, and I'll accept the consequences that Post hands down to me. But with consequences, I also understand consequences. I've got kids, and I get to play discipline games with them all the time. The only thing that I would hope for is when I catch the kid with his hand in the cookie jar, you know, they get scolded, maybe grounded, you know, but I don't cut their hand off and say, you know, you're going to suffer even longer than what you have to. So I just ask that whatever consequences this council decides is fitting, that they just be fair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Yockey, rebuttal?
Nothing in rebuttal, Your Honor. Counsel. Too many times in court. Apologize.
Oh. Your Honor. Jesus. First I'm a rapper. All right. Bring it back to the council for discussion. Any discussion, Sheriff? Ed Bunce.
I do have a clarification question, and perhaps I guess I need to address it to the director. How did we come to a Category C on this particular offense? Because as I read the post-disciplinary guidelines, this probably fits more within a Category A. And I'll tell you how I come to that. If you look at the facts of the case and then you apply them to our disciplinary guidelines, I believe domestic violence in the presence of a child is a Class A misdemeanor, is it not?
Yes.
I believe that it is. This was definitely a violent domestic assault in the presence of a child, which would definitely firmly place this particular offense into the Category A subcategory, according to my interpretation. Do you see it differently, Director?
No. Lieutenant Costa?
Can you speak to the conversations that we had in deciding the category?
I believe what we were looking at is we were looking at the type of activity that occurred. And we looked at what the individual was charged with, what he was convicted of, and took all of these into consideration. And we made a decision that it was a Class C. And we understand that there is an act of violence. We looked at the injuries that were sustained, and they didn't. They did not cause severe injuries to the individual. That's why we're looking at. That's why we're looking at.
Go
ahead, Sheriff.
Well, and I understand that, and I respect that, Lieutenant. I appreciate it, your response. I think it definitely is a Category A violation just by our guidelines. I think we've been very careful not to stray too far from these guidelines. So I believe that the council should look at this as a Category A violation. That's the way I see this by our guidelines, and I really don't think it's up for dispute. And I think it's pretty clear.
Sheriff, we looked at the category, it was a Class D misdemeanor, and he's not charged with a Class A, and that's why
Understood. And one of the things that we always take into consideration here at the Post Council is not only what they were charged with, but what they could have been charged with. Clearly, as I read through this, it was a violent domestic assault between two adults. That does not appear to be in dispute at all. The material facts of the case appear to be not in dispute as far as I can't see any dispute at all. I would recommend that we look at it as a Category A. Are we ready for, are we still discussing this, Chairman?
We'll give anybody else who wants to weigh in an opportunity, and then we'll entertain your motion, Sheriff.
Yes, sir.
Any other council members want to address this issue? No, then we'll bring it back to you, Sheriff. I think you want to make a motion.
Yes, sir. After looking at the details and considering this, I think deeply, I would make the motion that we recategorize this offense as Category A, or at least we look at it that way. And I would make the motion that we, instead of looking at a 3.5-year suspension, that we enact a 4-year suspension, and that if Deputy Bills comes back to law enforcement, that he has to go back through the police academy to do so.
All right. We have a motion on the floor. We have a second by Director Cook. Is there a discussion on the motion?
So, yeah, are we basing this off the fact that the Class B misdemeanors altogether are, you're viewing them as a greater offense, like a class?
Sorry.
You're okay. Because the domestic in the presence of a child, the assault, and the criminal mischief, those are just three Class B misdemeanors. So combined, is that what?
No. Domestic assault in the presence of a child is a Class A in and of itself.
If I may clarify that, it's 76.5109.1. Subsection 2, it's actually a Class B.
It's a Class B. I class
domestic violence in the presence of a child is...
I'm almost positive it's
a
Class
A. Person who violates subsection 2, which is what this would be, a person who commits domestic violence in the presence of a child, if a person, and then it states what they did. So subsection 3B states a person who violates subsection 2C is guilty of a Class B misdemeanor.
Okay. Well, that's why we pull out the code book from time to time. But I was almost sure that it was a Class A.
All right, we have...
Okay, if we're operating under that premise, I still think that this was an extremely violent domestic assault. If it's a Class A, then I would make the motion that we go with the post recommended suspension of 3.5 years. So I'll amend my motion.
If it's a Class B.
If it's a Class B. Is it?
Mr. Yockey, did you have additional information you wanted to share with the council?
If you could repeat the question.
Did you have any additional? I noticed you on the lieutenant.
Oh, so in regards to this, it would fall under Category C because it is a Class B misdemeanor. And the reason Post recommended 3.5 years was due to the aggravating circumstances, nature of the offense, and also the amount of offenses. Right. And so that's where we got the 3.5 years.
Okay. All right, so you've amended your motion. Director Cook, did you still want to second that?
I'll second it and say that it should be maximum for sure.
Okay, under guidelines, I believe it is under AC, 3.5 years. Any other discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?